It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strangchamps. What do you do when the headlines are freaking you out and the news is making you tense? A lot of people find sports takes their mind off things. It's like this one worry-free, politics-free zone. Right up until it isn't.
One of the beauties of the pandemic, one of the things that my son and I grabbed onto early on was the ritual of us going out running.
This is Kurt Streeter, a sports writer and a dad.
Just about every night we'd go for a mile or two, maybe 3 mile jog, and my son's a little 9-year-old just getting used to running, and he just loves it. And it was our time really to bond during this terrible time starting in March. Right around that time, I heard of the terrible shooting of Ahmaud Arbery down in Georgia.
Shot and killed white male
out for his daily jog.
Mostly white neighborhood.
The killing of a black jogger by a pair of white men.
Chased down and killed, hunted down like an animal.
At the time, no charges were filed.
My son didn't know about it. I kept that news from him, and my wife and I kept it from him, but it hit me. It hit me really hard. I wrote an essay then about the first jog that my son Ash and I had right after that killing. We happen to live in Seattle, which is a very white city, one of the whitest cities in America. I'm probably the only black homeowner, I think, for a couple of square miles. It's a pretty liberal neighborhood right now, but it does have a tangled past. I know about its past because I grew up in Seattle, and this was one of the neighborhoods where I would always be very wary of going when I was a young man. You know, this was a neighborhood where I had to be ready to fight, and that was because of race. So there's a neighborhood near us that's a fair amount more exclusive than the one that we live in, but that neighborhood is my son's favorite neighborhood to jog in. It's really scenic, it's beautiful, it's very quiet. It also makes me a little bit jumpy, I think, because I know about its exclusionary practices from the past. So the essay that I wrote was really, it started out with my son and I beginning our run and him saying that he wanted to go on the route. And me just turning to him and saying, you know, son, not today. We're not gonna go there today. I couldn't bear it mentally and emotionally that day to go through that neighborhood. There was just too much going on in my head and too many emotions. So we continued on in the route through our neighborhood. Even then, I have to worry still, and I constantly am worrying and checking myself, and are people seeing me as a prowler?
Attack on the black jogger.
She did call me the N-word.
White woman calling the police.
African-American man threatening my life.
I happen to really like looking at houses because I like design. But if I do that, what's somebody going to think? Are they going to think that I'm casing their place, and are they going to call the police?
Yeah.
Forced him into a patrol car.
Plus, I'm working out. You're bothering me.
All of these little things go through your head, and I've had a couple of instances where I've stopped to say a word or two to people on the street, and then I've seen their sort of shock at seeing me. You know, I'm 6'2", pretty big, broad-shouldered, athletic, you know, African-American man in this neighborhood. They can be a surprise to people, and sometimes you see a little bit of recoiling. So I had to dance around. I really didn't want to have him seeing that killing. I mean, shoot, I've covered gang killings in South LA, East Baltimore, but seeing that shooting, seeing Ahmaud Arbery and what happened to him, it just brought me to absolute tears, and it just laid me low, you know?
Kurt Streeter writes the Sports of the Times column for the New York Times. It's hard to remember. All that happened in March. Given all that we've gone through, all we're still going through, it seems like a decade ago. Sports, politics, and race have converged at other iconic moments in history. When Jesse Owens competed in the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany. When Jackie Robinson became the first black player in the major leagues. When Muhammad Ali refused to serve in the Vietnam War. All of which has made Steve Paulson wonder.
When historians write about this year in sports, what do you think they will write about?
I think that they'll write about a period when there was a new reckoning, where athletes finally found their footing and found their power and began speaking out, really in ways I think that have never occurred. I mean, the way that NBA being involved, the NFL.
Let's walk through some of that. So the NBA, during the playoffs, you know, there's weird playoff time in the bubble in Disney World in Orlando, all the NBA teams there, and the Milwaukee Bucks, my home team, boycotted a playoff game in response to the protests and the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Was that a big deal? Was that historic?
I absolutely believe it was. And you have a team, the Milwaukee Bucks, taking a stand like they did, and then the cascading effects where the entire league then decides, hey, we're not going to play. We are more than entertainers. We're human beings. We are connected to our communities. We're simply not going to take it anymore. And then the NBA stops playing for a while. It was unclear whether they were even going to come back, but they showed their power there in a way that had never been done for an entire league to stop playing, unprecedented.
And what I found striking about this, the league supported them. If this happened in football and the NFL, I'm not at all sure that the NFL would have supported players going on strike.
Yeah, the NBA and the NFL are just totally different beasts in the way that the way that ownership and particularly the commissioner's office deals with players and teams. And the NBA has become much more of a partnership between players and the league. And particularly the commissioner, Adam Silver, of the NBA seems to, you know, just have a very enlightened touch. So there's a great deal of trust there. And he gets it. He gets that this is a league that's 70% black. He has to understand and have empathy for the players.
So why is football so different?
You know, in all sports, the NFL is the kingpin, right? It's the biggest, baddest sport, and it's the most popular sport in America still. And there's just so much stereotyped imagery around football and machismo and really kind of, I got to say, sort of white America, you know, the white quarterback, the cowboy, literally. America's team is the Cowboys. And the players are much more kind of have to toe the line. The Colin Kaepernick situation and Black Lives Matter was handled. I mean, they completely shut that down.
Colin Kaepernick was, I mean, he's essentially been blacklisted in the NFL. He'll probably never play again because no team wants to take the risk of signing him again. I'm not sure that would happen in any other sport.
Exactly. And you see what you saw this year was the NFL then conveniently after George Floyd getting on the Black Lives Matter bandwagon for a while, and yet, conveniently, Colin Kaepernick always excluded. They don't even mention him. They don't even bring his name up. He's still able to play, most likely better than many of the quarterbacks in the NFL, and he's absolutely sidelined. He's just been banned from the league. The league would rather that he not exist, and they're just trying to erase him. But as far as Colin Kaepernick, the activist, they're actually making him more powerful, I think, in doing that. There's a power in that silence.
Yeah. But as you say, at least in the NBA and some other sports, black athletes do have more power now, more power than probably they've ever had in history. And I guess something has changed, right? Why is it different now than it was even a few years ago?
Well, you know, you have some really dynamic leaders. First of all, you've got LeBron James, and you've got people like Chris Paul in the NBA, and you've just got a whole generation of really astute star players who really get this. They're also wealthy beyond anything that their predecessors could have imagined, right? So they can speak up and not worry about their careers being cut short. They've made plenty of money. You know, they just feel more empowered.
Now, the other big thing, of course, that's had a huge impact on sports has been the lockdown. All the sports, professional, amateur, youth sports, shut down for months. And of course, they've sort of come back. Most of them have, at least. And I guess I'm wondering, If we learned anything about sports during that time, you are not only a sports columnist, you're a sports fan. Did you miss sports? Did it feel like actually we were missing something important during that time?
I think when anything is taken away from you like it was, and you sort of realize how much you took it for granted, the beauty and the joy that we get from sports, how much we want it, how much we crave it. But at the same time, I think like a lot of people, I mean, there's also a part of me, a big part of me, that feels guilty for this and feels like, man, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. We're in the middle of this terrible period right now.
I'm wondering if actually what mattered more, I mean, the bigger loss, I'm wondering if that was at the level of youth sports. All of those kids who really needed this outlet. Sports was one organized activity that really worked. All that was shut down for a long time.
You know, I've written about this a couple of times recently in Minneapolis, North Minneapolis High School, and their coach, Charles Adams, who is also a police officer. He's an African-American police officer. And North Minneapolis is really struggling with an uptick in violence and a sense among the kids of where do I go? What do I do? Everything's shut down. School is shut down. Community centers. What do I do? So Coach Adams' response is, we have to have football. We have got to have this place where these kids can be seen, can be heard, can be watched over, can feel a sense of community at least for a couple of hours a day. This has become a way for them really, honestly, to be safe. I live extremely cautiously through this, and I really believe that I'm skeptical about whether we should be playing sports right now just because of the ability to spread the virus.
Yeah.
We're taking an awful risk. But then again, we're sort of used to that in a way. If you're, you know, if you've been paying attention, let's say you're a football fan and you've been aware in the last several years of brain trauma issues in football, this is an extra layer. And this just speaks to the complications sometimes of all the time, really, in watching sports these days. There's always something that sort of makes it a little bit complicated that you kind of have to grapple with, a bit of a love-hate thing.
Yeah. Now, Kurt, you've mentioned that you're an athlete yourself. I mean, you were quite a serious tennis player earlier, a nationally ranked captain of the UC Berkeley tennis team. In fact, from what I've read, the first black captain in a predominantly white sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that one of the reasons you took up tennis was because you admired one of the great pioneers in tennis history, Arthur Ashe, one of the very few black players on the circuit in his time. What was it about Arthur Ashe that you found so inspiring?
Well, I think, you know, I got captured by Arthur Ashe and the love for Arthur Ashe when I was 9, 10 years old in 1975 when he won Wimbledon and beat Jimmy Connors in 4 sets. I remember watching that match, and I can just clear as day remember him coming out in his USA jacket and his just cool afro and his cool demeanor, and just thinking, wow, I want to be like that guy. And I never let go. One of the great moments of my life was when I was 16, 17 years old, and I'm, you know, sitting in my room one night, and I get a knock on the door from my mom, and I find out that Arthur Ashe was calling me, of all things. All those years later, Arthur Ashe, like he did for many, many young African-American, sort of national-ranked level tennis players, he reached down, and that night he was calling me to tell me that he was helping to fund me to be able to go down to the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, which is a famous tennis factory for junior players. Sure. I mean, it was just kind of the craziest thing and the luckiest thing in the world that my idol is literally just calling me one night. Again, I'm hardly the only one. Hardly the only one. He did that a lot and with really no fanfare.
And you said that your son is named Ash, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Little Ash. I hope Arthur is proud from above.
Yeah.
And again, it's mostly just the humanitarian aspect and just the way he walked through the world is something that I just deeply admire and hope that I can kind of, you know, tap into a bit and hope that I can pass on to my son.
Kurt Streeter writes the Sports of the Times column for the New York Times. And we'll hear more from Steve later this hour. And now, an extraordinary documentary about the NFL champion who used silence as a weapon against the sports media complex.
We will listen in live here on NFL Network with Beast Mode.
When do my time start? Oh, it started? Well, then let me start. Hey, I'm just here so I don't get fined, so y'all can sit here and ask me all the questions y'all want to. I'm going to answer with the same answer, so y'all can shoot if y'all please. I'm here so I won't get fined.
That's the Seattle Seahawks former star running back Marshawn Lynch, nicknamed Beast Mode, and that is not the way the NFL wanted him to behave in press conferences.
I'm just here so I won't get fined.
Lynch began stonewalling the press in 2013. The league had a fit. They fined him tens of thousands of dollars, but Lynch wouldn't give in. His silence became a very public form of resistance.
Hey, you better make more with your time. You only got 3 more minutes.
Writer David Shields has just released a stylistically fearless documentary made of 700 video clips with no narration called Marshawn Lynch, A History.
You're still here because what?
So I won't get fined.
Charles Monroe Kane wanted to know why.
The reason I made the movie, the reason that I was sort of fell in love with him as a subject was that, you know, in this world of professional athletes in which the huge majority of athletes play by the rules and either are spinning themselves as brand or are giving these upbeat answers or these painfully cliched answers, Marshawn had the performance art chops, the cultural awareness, the bravado, the swagger, the nerve, the wit to somehow go Bartleby on all these people. You remember that famous Melville novella, Bartleby the Scrivener, in which Bartleby always says, I would prefer not to.
Right, right.
And Marshawn, you know, he sort of stiff-armed the American media for several years and simply said, I dare you to make me answer your unbelievably banalizing, colonizing, and dehumanizing questions. And in so doing, I think, flipped the script on American culture in ways that I would argue still resonate.
David, I want to back up a second. I think we're getting really far ahead. I want to back up for a second and talk about the NFL. NFL is a very big and powerful thing, right? And early in Lynch's career, he was arrested. He was arrested twice for hit and run and arrested for guns. Mm-hmm. These are very serious things. The NFL totally tolerated it. And they just got their PR machine going and away it went, right? But it's funny, when Marshawn Lynch started ignoring the press and giving these repeated answers, then the NFL came down hard. And I found it really hard to believe when watching your film that they cared more about him speaking to the press than they did a gun charge.
It's a really great point. It's a really great irony and paradox. And that gets spun through what's the phrase that the NFL always likes to use? Protect the shield, everything to build
protect
brand.
The shield, right.
And the NFL is a very complicated thing. On the one hand, it's selling violence, and it's sort of selling itself as, you know, a galaxy of people who commit violence on the field, and we're going to wink and turn away. It's extraordinary the number of things that players do and then are brought back into the league. What isn't part of American messaging is to say, I would prefer not to. To say, I am not going to speak in the master's voice.
But David, why do they care? I mean, I'm trying to get at the NFL side of this for a second. Why do they care if Marshawn does this or not? Why not market him as a freak out free spirit and have the guy never speak? Like, I don't get why they care that much. They were fining him $100,000 for not doing these press conferences. Who cares?
Who is to say that Marshawn Lynch's silence is implicitly political and radical? Hey, looks like the NFL thinks it is, because otherwise, why does it spook them out? Because, I mean, part of what the NFL is selling, it seems to me, is that it's part of corporate speak. It's part of business speak. It's part of the American corporate industrial sports media complex. And if someone says, I'm not playing that game, I have enough talent, enough power that I'm going to cash your checks. I'm going to play football because I really love it and am, you know, colossally good at it. He wants to hold on to his actual soul. We're all trapped in the matrix of American capitalism. He's actually trying to be true to himself, and he's doing a better job of it than most of us, where he was able to cash checks and not totally sell his own extraordinary soul.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about, you know, basketball and the championship just happened, and I was thinking about LeBron, right? These athletes who play the game, they know the drill, right? It's just like, hey, LeBron, how does it feel to be one game away from the championship? And LeBron answers, it's one game at a time. I don't see game seven as any different of any game. We just need to execute and stick to the game plan. I can't imagine being asked the stupid questions over and over and over again. Why do you think it happens that way? Why are these sports journalists, who ones would assume are well-educated and thoughtful, why are they asking the same stupid questions all the time? Because they're ridiculous.
I've been thinking about that question for the longest time. How did that convention develop? And Marchand even asked the question toward the end of the film. He says, I'm bored by these questions. I've been hearing these questions for 20 years. You know, he started playing sort of serious football by age, say, 14, and he's now 33 or 34. You know, he's been hearing the same damn questions for, you know, 20 years. And as Marchand says, there's only so many questions you can ask a player about a football game. It's not, as they say, rocket science.
Right.
It's not that complicated. So I think part of it is to pretend that the game is immeasurably complex and give it a kind of
hey, this is more important
science.
Than it is, right?
Yeah. But I think a bigger part is it's to take this extraordinary spectacle, which to me is processing huge amounts of American history, the idea of a majority white audience looking at black bodies in positions of violence and contortion. I mean, if you look at the NFL combine and with these black athletes in almost no clothing being timed and measured by white coaches, it's a very uncomfortable echo of slavery. It's just a very weird spectacle. And I think the NFL in particular, which is overwhelmingly black, you know, overwhelmingly owned by white owners, overwhelmingly covered by white media, processed by American media companies, you know, a majority white audience. I do think what is happening is that there's an amazing cultural residue coming through the NFL, having to do with Black Lives Matters and racial violence and slavery and segregation and terror and rage and hatred and bodies and money. And I think there's something that happens, especially in the NFL, in which the issues are so alive. What's going on is so exciting and confusing and troublemaking that there's this crucial business move, it seems to me, that happens is let's banalize it. Let's totally domesticate it. And let's just turn it into, it's no more radical what we are watching or no stranger than if we were selling, you know, nachos.
You know, David, there's a powerful moment for me in the film. I think it was before the Super Bowl, where I'm sure his press junkets were incredible. They were everywhere, left and right. He had to do all the stuff. Maybe he was nervous, all this going on. And there's this one press conference where he sits down in the chair and he says to the, I think they have 5 minutes or 6 minutes. He has to do the press.
Oh, this is amazing. Yeah.
And he sits down and he says, I'll just be looking at y'all the way that y'all be looking at me. And he puts on sunglasses, leans back and stares at them for 6 minutes. And he just stood there. I'm like, wow, this guy has got guts. And I think people were scared. I think people were upset. Somebody,
exactly.
I think, yelled from the background. One of the journalists was a woman who said, oh, this is all about you, Marchand, huh? Like that. He was like, he wasn't taking the bait. What do you do with a moment like that in Culture History where he basically says, I'm just be looking at y'all the way y'all look at me?
It's brilliant. I mean, it's an amazing moment. And he is wearing, I believe at that time, a medallion of a map of Africa, in case that you're missing the cultural point. And he also is running wearing sunglasses so that he is blocking, I would argue, kind of the white media gaze and sending that gaze straight back at the journalist. Marchand is taking that gaze and sending it right back at the gazer and implicitly to me flipping the power switch and saying, who has the power now? I'm not an object of your gaze. You now are the object of my gaze. And it makes people very uncomfortable. How do you participate in this culture, American culture, as a black man without selling your soul? And he figured out a pretty narrow path through it.
Hey, look, I don't know what story y'all trying to get out of me. I don't know what image y'all trying to portray of me. All of my requirements are fulfilled. So now for this next 3 minutes, I'll just be looking at y'all the way that y'all looking at me. Thank you.
Marshawn Lynch has retired from pro football a couple of times, but he could still be back. He's 34 years old and a free agent. Charles Monroe Kane was talking with David Shields about his new documentary. It's called Marshawn Lynch, A History. Coming up, the sport famous for giving women a direct path to personal power, roller derby. You're listening to the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Remember this?
In the world of roller games, there's room at the top for only one. And there's only one Kansas City Bomber. And she's the hottest thing on wheels.
Casey, go, 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 Casey, go! Casey Carr up in front. The Bomber is at it again.
Ladies, 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 let's be ladies here.
Listen, big brother, you're a big fat tub of lard, you can't skate any better than you look.
This is the world of roller games, where the only thing more dangerous than the competition is some of the fans.
Don't laugh at me!
Kansas City Bomber, starring Raquel Welch, who was made in 1972. Coincidentally, that was the exact same year Title IX was enacted, giving girls equal access to athletics. Roller derby is in the midst of a renaissance right now. There are leagues on every continent. Tens of thousands of women are finding empowerment in an aggressive, high-contact sport with in-your-face feminist moxie. Among them, Melissa Jewelwan. Her memoir, Roller Girl, begins with her first practice.
Honestly, it was pretty terrible. All the girls were there who had skated in the bout, and the energy in the rink on the day after a bout is really interesting because it's kind of like warriors who've come back from battle and they're kind of jaded and tired, but they're also really proud and victorious. So they were all in their like post-bout glow and recovery period. And I walked in like a little puppy, like, hi, everybody, I'm here. I'm ready to skate. This is so great. You guys are so cool. And they looked at me like I was out of my mind.
You know, roller derby is a pretty fierce sport. There are a lot of fights. The girls skate really fast and really hard. Mm-hmm. People get hurt. Did it scare you?
I think I was more scared of the emotional part than the physical part. I was more worried about fitting in and having people think that I was cool because I really wanted to be like them. I never really thought about the physical part. And it's funny, I brag quite a bit in the book about never having an injury because I worked out off the track too. And then as soon as I turned in my manuscript to my publisher, I tore my rotator cuff at a practice and added myself to the list of girls who were injured playing roller derby. So yeah, pride goeth before the fall, right?
So when you say you really wanted to be like them, what does that mean? Because the roller girl look or the roller girl culture is this strange mix. It's kind of mean girls in mini skirts.
Mm-hmm.
the sexy female bruiser. Was that what you wanted to be?
Yeah, I think it was the confidence that really attracted me because all of the girls, no matter what size or shape or age or the persona they took on, each of them was very confident in the persona they'd chosen for themselves. And I really wanted to feel that way too. I mean, every one of them believes that they are the sexiest, strongest, fastest, most awesome. And I really wanted to think that about myself. And being around them made me think, well, if I create that persona, eventually I'll be that girl.
What's with the stage names the girls have? You know, Raquel Welts, Malice in Wonderland, Cherry Chainsaw. Why do they have these stage names?
Well, I think partially it started just for fun. When roller derby started, I don't think most of the girls who were skating really anticipated it was going to become a legitimate sport. So it was just another fun aspect of dressing up. And for some of the leagues, after the Texas Roller Girls started, when it spread, in some of the more conservative parts of the country, girls felt more comfortable taking on a persona and a made-up name because then they could really clearly separate their day jobs and their regular lives from their roller derby lives. So they kind of were able to hide inside of their skater names so they could be normal at work and have this other persona outside of work. For me, it was really liberating to create a persona and take on a new name because Malicious can do a lot of things that Melissa Jewel Wan really can't do.
Like what?
Malicious is much braver. And it's kind of bled over into my real life. If you talk to my husband, he'll tell you. There's no shy retiring parts of me anymore. But in the beginning, I really took a lot of strength from saying to myself, okay, I'm just going to pretend to be Malicious. She wouldn't be afraid to pick up the telephone. She wouldn't be afraid to wear the push-up bra. Whatever it is, from silly to important, it really helped to think about how a character that I wanted to be would behave in a situation and then adopt that behavior.
Well, let's talk some about the athletics behind roller derby, because it is a real sport with real rules, penalties, positions even. Is it a hard sport?
It's pretty demanding. Number one, of course, you have to be able to skate well enough that you're not thinking about skating at all. And I think that we all aspired to be like hockey skaters. I mean, if you watch ice hockey teams, they're amazing. Forward, backward, able to turn in both directions, crossovers, the whole thing. They're not thinking about their feet. So the first thing we had to do was really work on our skating skills. And then once you've got that conquered, you have to think about how to use your body as a battering ram. So then we're kind of pulling in some stuff from football with body blocks and how to fall and roll and get up quickly. And then there's the strategy involved in the sport. When you first start watching the game, it's kind of hard to see that there's strategy involved. But there is some strategy in how you help the jammer get through the pack and when the jammer should speed up and attempt to score and when to kind of pull back based on where the other jammer is.
Okay, what's the jammer?
Getting ahead of the game, huh?
Who's the jammer?
Okay, so there are three positions, jammer, blocker, and pivot. The jammer is the person who's responsible for scoring points for the team. They're generally sprint skaters. They can be tiny, but we've also seen really successful large jammers because they can kind of barrel their way through the pack. The blockers do what their name implies. They get in the way of the opposing team's jammer, and they also assist their jammer through the pack, making holes to help them get through so they can score points. And then the pivot is a specialized blocker who skates at the front of the pack. And the pivot's job is to control the speed of the pack. So if their jammer's coming, they want to slow down a little bit so that their jammer can get through to score. Meanwhile, the other pivot is trying to speed up the pack so that the competition can't score.
Does it ever bother you that the whole girls fighting thing is kind of like a male fantasy on wheels?
I think that one of the really appealing aspects of roller derby is that it allows us to kind of take those male fantasy perceptions and flip them around a little bit. Like, we always referred to skaters as the girls. I can remember talking to some people about that and them saying, well, why do you call yourselves girls? That seems so demeaning. I was like, well, we're calling ourselves girls. We're taking ownership of that. And you can call it third wave of feminism, or you can just call it having fun. I don't think any of us take that part of it too seriously. And we're happy to have the fans come. If some of them are coming because they want to see a sport and some of them are coming because they want to see girls in fishnets, that's awesome. We're wearing the fishnets. We wouldn't be doing it if we didn't think it looked really hot.
Melissa Jewell Juan, author of Roller Girl, Totally True Tales from the Track. Kind of makes you want to sign up, doesn't she? Speaking of sports and empowerment, let's talk about res ball, high school basketball on Native American reservations. There's something a little different about it. Extra magic. Unusual defense.
Our second game of this week.
You tell us one story of when this Navajo team played the neighboring Apache team.
Red Cloud comes in 15-1. They're ranked number 5 in the state.
It's comical.
Should be a great matchup tonight.
The medicine men from both groups are trying to cast spells on the other team.
Oh, yeah. No, it was, they came out before the game, and normally, of course, everybody would shake hands. If you carry a bad spell, traditionally for both Navajo and Apache, you would carry it in the palm of your hand. So none of them will shake hands with each other. They're literally like touching their elbows or their forearms to each other. I talked with Raul Mendoza, the coach that I was with, but also with the Apache coach afterwards. They said, yeah, they're both convinced the other team has, like, the serious mojo.
The tip will come down to Jayshon Morissette and over to Bo Donovan. Red Cloud has the ball.
You will see medicine men standing up in the top of the bleachers, and they're kind of just talking to themselves, and what they're doing is they're saying prayers or whatever they're saying.
Brown's going to take a deep three.
Inside the world of res ball, next. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about the personal politics of sports, how the personal, individual experience of playing a game or competing athletically intersects with larger social and political structures. Fundamentally, sports is about power, and not just on the field. New York Times reporter Michael Powell saw that firsthand when he spent a season covering high school basketball at Chinle High School in the Navajo Nation in Arizona. The story he tells in his book Canyon Dreams is about basketball, and a lot more, as Steve Paulson discovered
So res basketball, basketball in the reservation is a really big deal, right?
It's a really big deal. As one of the coaches said, he said the five biggest sports on the reservation are basketball, 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 rodeo, or the reverse.
So this is a particular style of ball?
Yes. It's res ball, which is this incredibly fast-paced, run, 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 pass, 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 cut, cut, cut. Played well, it's beautiful.
Where does that style come from?
Yeah, it really comes out of, I think, their history and their culture. The Bureau of Indian Affairs for generations used to come and force families to give up their kids that would go to faraway boarding schools where the idea, as they said, was to, you know, basically burn the Indian out of them. And they would wash out their mouths if they spoke Navajo and all this kind of thing. They started playing basketball at these places. And what is sort of wonderful is that they made it their own. And how so? Number one, running, distance running, goes deep into all the tribes of the Southwest, the Hopis, the Pueblo tribes, the Apache, and the Navajo. And the other is they have a very communal culture. So basketball, this kind of the idea of 5 or 10 kids melding together, very much kind of fits in with their culture. It's interesting when they really get going, they'll often bring in players in groups. It's almost like hockey. Whole separate slot of guys.
So you have
in.
Like five guys subbing out and then five
yes,
new guys.
And, then five,
and they just run at full speed.
Yes, yes. Run, run, run. Now, played badly, it can be chaotic. Like all sports, done well, it's a thing of beauty, and done not so well, it's not so much a thing of beauty.
Well, and I would think especially if they're playing teams off the res, the white kids who are sometimes quite big, maybe they can run circles around them.
That's a great point, because it's very interesting to watch them play teams off the res, particularly Anglo teams, white teams. Almost invariably, in fact, I think with this team, they played their best games against those sort of teams because there was a sort of a concentration, frankly, a matter of pride. So these big teams would come in very often. Front lines, 6'6", 6'7". I mean, the tallest kid on the Navajo team was 6'3". After that, there was one kid who was 6 foot. Everybody else was under 6 foot.
So why is basketball such a big deal on the reservation?
Well, at this point, it's generational. Families will come in, great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, cousins, aunties and uncles. It's not unusual to see from any one of the players' families 15, 18 people come to a game. They'll sit there through the ninth grade games, ninth grade girls and boys, JV boys and girls, varsity boys and girls. So they'll be there for 6 hours, a lot of these families.
So this is the big social event.
This is the event. And they'll have 5,000 people. I mean, Chinle is a town of 3,500. They'll have 5,000 at big games.
So they come in from the...
all over the place.
Wow.
Guys will hitchhike in from the outback. All of those generations have played hoop. And to dominate at the high school level is like the Everest for Navajo because, particularly with the boys, they don't go on. They're not big enough to play big D1 schools. I mean, they just can't do that. So that most of them, this is it. A few will play community college ball.
You got to know the coach of this team, this 70-year-old guy who had spent decades coaching, not so much at this school, but all kinds of different schools, mostly on different parts of various reservations. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Raul Mendoza was a terrific character and kind of my, in a sense, my guide, because he was a Tono Odom Indian. I may have butchered the pronunciation, but it's a tribe, quite poor tribe, that spans the border, Mexico and Arizona, and came north, taught himself English, got an education. He's coached essentially on the Navajo or the Apache, and the Apache are sort of their genetic cousins, the same Athabascan people. And he's coached on those reservations his entire life. He's married to a Navajo, but he's never of Navajo, and people know that. At the same time, he is a Native American, and he understands, you know, all of their cultural yearnings, the fears. Do you leave the reservation? If you leave, can you ever come back? Can you make your way in the Anglo world if you want to get an education? So he spends a lot of time on head work, essentially, with these teenage boys.
So I'm assuming this is a lot more than just plotting out the X's and O's of basketball games. He's a counselor. He's guiding these young men into figuring out what to do with their lives.
That is precisely how he conceives of his thing. As he says, you know, he's about turning around in 20 years and hopefully seeing most of these boys living productive, healthy lives. And that's not such an easy thing if you're coming from the reservation in northern Arizona.
Life is hard there for most of these kids, right?
Yes, it's very hard. It's an enormous place. It's the size of West Virginia. There's not much there. I mean, let's assume that you're one of those kids 5 years later and you've gotten yourself a college education, you come back, you could work as a school teacher. There's jobs at the hospital. And then there's a few other jobs. That's it. I mean, the unemployment runs 40% approximately. They deal with all the problems that confront not just Native Americans. I mean, certainly we're hearing a lot about rural America, right, and the terrible problems confronting whites in rural America. But I mean, they confront those same problems. But alcohol is their great carnivore, their great pursuer, and that's a big problem. And so, you know, if a kid comes back, let's say he's got a degree, and he comes back, and at first you're welcomed by all your hundreds of relatives, and everybody's really happy to see you, and then you look up a couple of months later, and it's like, well, now what do I do?
Yeah. I would think for you, as this Anglo reporter coming into the Navajo Nation, writing the story, it must have been hard. Was there any part of the story that was especially hard for you to understand? I don't know, maybe traditional Navajo beliefs?
Yes. I mean, certainly the traditional Navajo beliefs fascinated me, and it's a completely different cosmology.
You tell these stories that are just remarkable. I mean, stories of apparitions and shape-shifting and animals turning into people, and these weren't just once-in-a-lifetime kind of stories. I mean, it sounds like this stuff happened fairly often.
Oh, no, there is a profound belief in the immaterial there. I heard it from virtually everyone there. I first started to notice it when, before games, big games, the boys would all like roll up, you know, either bee pollen or different herbs into their socks. Every family would do a protection way prayer, usually before the season. Sometimes there would be prayers before big games. Now, you could say, well, you know, okay, in the NBA, you see guys pointing to the heavens or crossing themselves. This is different. This is a real sense that tonight there could be medicine men in the stands putting a hex on me, like doing things that are going to make it difficult for me to play well.
And does any of this seem to work?
They're convinced it does. There was one incident in particular. This was not while I was there. It was a couple years earlier. They'd played, I think it was on Hopi. And all of them, including the coach, Raul Mendoza, said that they felt like they were playing underwater the whole game. Everything was moving in slow motion. This was a very big game, like in a haze. All described the same thing. The next day, somebody that he knew, that Raul Mendoza knew, said, well, yeah, you've got to realize that the medicine men for the Hopi had put kachinas, their magical dolls, at all four corners of the arena and had done ceremonies before that were designed to leave you befogged. You know, who am I to say? I mean, you start to hear these stories. I mean, Mendoza, who, interestingly enough, was a Assemblies of God evangelical. He is a serious Christian. But, you know, he had a tale coming back. It was when he was coaching on Apache, and some of the families were angry that their kids weren't playing. And one of the families that was angry, the mother was a very powerful witch. He had been warned that she was going to put spells on him. And one night, he's driving back through the White Mountains to his home, and his daughter is following behind in a car. He's in his pickup truck and a enormous alabaster white owl, just enormous, dives right at his window in his telling. He kind of flinches, and at the last second, it zooms up into the air, doesn't hit the window, goes up over his car. Now the daughter picks up the story. She's about 100 yards behind him. It's middle of winter. There's snow on the ground. It comes down, lands on the asphalt right behind his truck, and turns into a white alabaster person and runs off into the woods. Raul and his daughter, they don't drink a lick. They are not, tellers of tall tales. They said this happened. Just it flat out happened.
So what do you do with those stories? You were in this culture for months, living there, listening to all of this. How do you process that?
I think there's, to the extent that I can figure these things out, I do believe that there is a notion of a collective unconscious. I heard too many of these stories from people in a matter-of-fact way. It wasn't like to make you scared. It's just like, this is life. So I guess I take them seriously. That's a different thing than saying I know what to make of them, because I don't. But I think the immaterial, the membrane between the material and the immaterial is so thin as at times almost not to exist. And who's to say that they aren't open for that reason to things that, lie in our dim past of our peoples?
Yeah. It's a great story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Powell is a New York Times reporter and the author of Canyon Dreams. He talked with Steve Paulson.
The Doomsday Defense.
Whether you play sports or watch sports, or just know someone who does, I hope we've helped you think about sports as more than a game, but as an arena for the same social issues we take to the polls or to the streets. Race, gender, equality, freedom. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our team includes Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Joe Hartke, Steve Paulson, and me, Ann Strange Champs. Thanks for listening, and be well.
Another decisive move by the Doomsday Defense.